give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Massey and Paul. This is episode 10 of season 3. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. The show does contain film spoilers, so if you have not yet seen the film, I would advise watching it first. It might help you understand a little bit better. Now for today's show, I hope you enjoy.
Okay, so welcome everybody, and this week we are watching All or Nothing, and we have... what term would we use? Offaly senior hurling manager, former Kilkenny hurler, Ballyhale hurler, whatever, we keep going. Michael Finley's joining us. So Michael, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, lads. Thanks very much. Looking forward to the chat.
Very good. And like, I suppose, look, first of all, what, like, you're a former player, now you're coaching. What got you into the coaching side of things?
I've had an interest in it over the last maybe, I'd say probably 7, 8, 9 years. I'd say even as a player, in my mid-20s onwards, I had an interest in coaching and developing people, helping people. Obviously, loved the game of hurling in particular, and I suppose it would have helped out with different teams, you know, with different sessions every so often. And I really enjoyed, doing the session. And I suppose from there, I knew I had a passion for it. And from there, I would have always looked at what managers were doing and learning, I suppose, from what they were doing and what works, what doesn't work. So it's just an innate interest, really, Colm.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, one of the things that I suppose we would have had a chat about previously, but, like, did you find that it actually helped your playing career, the more into the coaching and the understanding from that side of things came along?
It doesn't, to be honest. You know, what I found actually was I was reading... reading articles and that on coaching and managers and leadership, and I found myself looking into that a bit early in my life, because I was still a player and I still had to keep that player mode and player mindset on and not to be getting too caught up with the coaching side of it. So I think it helped in some shape or form. But even with nutrition, like, you know, I was back doing a master's in 2013 and started learning more about nutrition, and next thing I found myself changing my diet in 2014, and I was trying to eat more healthier and eat more greener, and it was causing trouble then with my performances, because I wasn't getting enough calories into myself, you know, because normally before a game you'd be having just and before training sessions you'd be having your white bread sandwiches, your bottle of Lucozade, you know, and a banana. And I just, you know, I got caught up in the whole thing, to be honest. And, you know, at the end of the day, you have to do what works for you, and you have to get the calories and the energy into you. And everyone's very different. So that's probably a good example of how it can catch you at times.
Yeah, I suppose getting the balance right between the academic side of it and the on-the-pitch side, it can be very important.
And very different on that, you know, like academically, you could be taught one thing, but when you go out on the field, you know, it can be very different. And you have 30 plus lads, you know, in a dressing room, they've all got 30 different tastes or 30 different personalities, and something that might work for me might not work for someone else, even though, you know, theoretically it says it should be this way, you know. So it's definitely a balance, and there's a lot of practical learning that has to be done on the field.
And did you find through your studies and through being coached by so many different coaches that when you took up the interest in coaching yourself, that when something's being explained to you or tactics are being thrown out or whatever, that you thought, when I become a coach, I might do this in a different way, I might explain it in a different way, and you start questioning yourself and question the coaches, but not, you know, you're not throwing it out them, if you get me.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I think the do's and the don'ts, you kind of bank them things, you say that worked. And then you see the things that didn't work, you're like, God, no, that does not work, and that will not work. So that's something I'm going to avoid, you know. And I think that comes with experience as a player. And even through, as I mentioned earlier, through my PhD, it's very much in the area of coaching and at intercounty level, and managing, and the player's point of view, and the coach's point of view, and the backroom's point of view. And from there, I suppose, it's important to see, you know, what angles that they're looking at. And that's the beauty of it, I think. Like, and even now, I suppose I'm seeing all those angles as well and learning from that. So definitely you learn a lot from the experience side of things. And I suppose the point I was actually getting to there was one of the coaches would have mentioned, he's 10 years as a coach now. And he said, I've learned a lot of what not to do. I wouldn't have the confidence yet to be a manager, as he said, but I definitely know the things that I shouldn't be doing. So definitely experience will bring a lot of learning.
And Mick, do you think there's a there in terms of what you're seeing there between the coaches and the manager's perspective and the players' perspective, that there's a bit of a disconnect there in terms of, we'll say, a player's understanding of a game in comparison to the managers and how they communicate with each other? Is that something that's coming up at the moment, or what's it like?
Yeah. Communication, Paul, you've read some of my results already. Communication is banging out. And it's not really understanding the game or how it played out. It's trying to get your message across. And it can be in so many ways. And how do you get that message across, and how do you word it? And, you know, do you do it through, you know, verbal, non-verbal? At the moment, we're struggling with the pandemic. You know, we can't be in dressing rooms with players. We can't have meetings. So how do you do it? Do you do it online? And are the 30-plus players getting the message, or half of them getting the message? So that's the other side of it. How long do you talk for? What cues do you use? So no, definitely communication is a big aspect of some of the results that I'm finding. And it's keeping keeping the channels open between the players, between the manager, between the backroom team. Like, that's key. And that's tough. Like, that's, you know, we're running training 3 nights a week. You're on the field, you know, you're into the business end of it very, very quickly. So it's hard to have those communications completely open the whole time. And you don't want to have meetings every week either. Like, people get bored of meetings. Thankfully, back in my time, I didn't have many meetings as a player, and I was thankful for it, because you can overdo it. So it's getting that balance right. And that's why communication is very challenging. And that's why it's coming up in the results for at the moment.
Did you, listening to Steve Bruce and the little communication issue they had at Newcastle during the week there, any of you guys know? Where he gave a player was coming on as a sub, and whatever the message was to the rest of the team, you have to defend in such a way, and they conceded a goal straight away. And suppose he called the player out in the dressing room and said in the media about it wasn't communicated right, and they had a bit of a barney at training, where Steve Bruce charged out of the office when the assistant manager told him what the player said, and he had a bit of a pushing and shoving. And it was just all just communication, as you mentioned.
Yeah, 100%. Like, look, it's especially during the time of the game, like, you know, as a player, you're coming on and you might be thinking of something else, and the manager's trying to get his message through to you, and you might not have explained it too well. And even as a player, how can you get that message to the rest of the 10 players in soccer so quickly? And like, as we all know, the last week or two, Damaire Fearn now is not allowed onto the field in the GAA for this year, for 2021. So that's going to bring more challenges to how do you get a message onto the field to make changes, to make switches, to change tactics, for example. So that's going to be another huge barrier and challenge. And I don't know what's going to happen on that side of things, to be honest. So and I have to say, like, I'd be in one sense favourable to it, because I think when the Mayor Ferner comes onto the field, there can be conflict, there can be issues, there can be, you know, being involved in the game that you shouldn't be, and there can be involvement with players, and I don't think that's right either. But, you know, we need a balance as well, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that was actually one of the things in the film that was really good, was the fact, and even you've seen it a couple of weeks ago with Johnny Sexton, they have players, their injured players, doing water boying and giving messages there on the rugby side of things. And even the tall, gangly S&C coach was highly involved,
yeah,
highly involved in delivering messages on the field, you know, which I thought was good. And he was always getting involved in the game, but was still able to deliver the message coherently in terms of what he was doing, you know.
And he said in such a way as that this is coming from upstairs, so they knew it was, you know, directed from management straight like that. I suppose pushing on, like, during the year when there's no more Ferna, I'd say your physios and your doctors are going to have more of an important role to play.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's one way of maybe getting the message in there, but I've no doubt managers will be looking at different ways of doing it and coming up with innovative ideas. But yeah, look, it's, you know, will the 15-minute break for the water break still be there? You know, I think that would be helpful if it was, because at least the game doesn't go on for the 35 minutes that maybe, you know, between 15 and 20 minutes, you still had a chance to make changes, to have a chat with players. And I think for me, that's important, especially if Damaire Fearn is gone, because otherwise it'll be chaos trying to change things, especially if the game is going downhill and you want to make changes and you want to do things. It's very, very difficult. And even a player coming onto the field, again, as I said, for him to go around to the players, you can't do that. In GAA, you cannot do it. In rugby, you can, because there's stoppages. Players can come together. In the GAA, that does not happen. So it'd be interesting, as I said, to see what will actually happen, how that will evolve.
Yeah, and there will be the element of a fella going down injured, and there'll be little huddles on the pitch in a match circumstances, trying to break momentum. And it will be interesting to see. But there's also the element of, look, it's good that the message is gone, because there's nearly a bit of PlayStation coaching going on with some teams that play, the manager is telling them exactly what to do. And look, in them last few minutes of a match, like, you can't be handheld. You've been in enough matches that have been down to a point or two in the last couple of minutes. And irregardless of the message that's being delivered, it's depending on what's been built into you over a period of time. Like,
yeah, 100%. Like, it's what's built into the system. And and very much that way, players need to, you know, stand on their own 2 feet and decide, you know, what needs to be done. And you can't spoon feed them, and you have to prepare them for those days. And I'd be very much of that opinion. And even actually, just funnily enough, you know, we'll talk about the All Blacks shortly and the All or Nothing series. But going back previous to that, you know, back probably maybe 15 odd years, just reading a paper basically on the time Graham Henry was involved with the All Blacks when he was manager. And I suppose they had a lot of issues around 01, 02, 03 in particular, in terms of the performance of the All Blacks, what was going on. There was issues off the field as well. And the whole thing was falling apart, to be honest, in terms of what was going on. And you wouldn't, you know, I think a lot of people wouldn't even realise that. Normally think the All Blacks has been a solid kind of a uniform that's never been broken. But definitely back then there was issues. And funny enough, they had a huge transformation back then in terms of his management style. He went very much from an autocratic manager style to a transformational manager style. So basically trying to help players regroup, trying to make them leaders, and just leading back to your point, Paulie, to try and get players to make decisions on the field. They wanted to empower that more. They wanted to reinforce that. And, you know, what they found was they had some sort of an old leadership group, but it wasn't doing anything. So they said, here, let's give these lads more accountability on the field, and let's let them grow into that role. And, you know, funny enough, Steve Henson was actually an assistant coach back then as well. So he would have seen that. And I think it was in 2007, the World Cup, they lost in the quarter final. So they did all that and they still kind of failed, you could say. But those structures were in place. Those foundations were being built, and they didn't go away from it. They actually built further on it, you know, and that's impressive in terms of their whole change. And there was a whole culture shock to them, I suppose, to change that direction. And as I'm saying, the decisions are key, and players need to be empowered and they need to be trusted to make them on the field.
Yeah, no, and you know, it's something, and look, I know we're only getting really insights in the documentary. One of the things that stood out to me was that last couple of minutes before they went onto the pitch all the time, there was no coaches or managers in the dressing room giving messages. It was very much the players giving out that final message in All or Nothing.
And that goes back, Paulie, to 2003 and 2004. The manager, Henry, and again, it's a paper, I'll send it on to you. Henry got feedback from the players, and he said, like, basically the player said, we don't know why you're talking. And he's like, well, thank God you're honest with me. He goes, I've been doing all this talking the whole time. It's not any good. Leave the players alone. Leave them sorted themselves, you know. And like, he would always went in and made a spiel about what to do. And what they found from that was, it wasn't really having any effect. So hand it over to the players, you know. And you see probably Davy Fitz would have done it probably with the Wexford lads, just, I suppose, as a supporter over the last number of years now. Watching games, you know, you'd see Davy out in the field and the Wexford players would still be in the dressing room. So he'd be handing it over to the players as well to take it on and to drive it on. So there definitely is elements of that occurring in the GAA, which is nice to see.
Yeah, and, you know, another thing that stuck out as well was with Hansen, there was one stage, and I can't remember which player it was, but he was after going through a bad game or two, and everyone was in his ear, and Hansen ended up going over and goes, stop talking, there's 20 lads talking to the bastard, there's way too much talking going on, leave him alone. Like, it was great, because you get to the stage where there is too much talking, and with Hansen, numerous times in it, like, when there was a message to be delivered, it was just do your job.
It keeps quite simple, yeah. And I recall that incident, and I think it was number 10, Ireland side number 10. Maybe it's Pernara, is the Pernara, maybe the pronunciation is poor now. Another player. Okay. The two scrum halves, yeah, they were hounding a bit, like, and to be fair, Henson came over and spotted him. He said, leave him alone. You have to trust him. There's no point everyone being in his ear. And to be fair, like, it's good to see players being challenged and players challenging themselves, but you don't overdo it either, because that player will lose confidence. So it's getting the balance right. And he came in, you know, quite chilled and quite like, look, just leave him alone. And that's it. Like, so his style is interesting. Like, you know, and he's been there since, like, you know, I think maybe 2003 as an assistant coach, became manager in 2012, then as head coach, and was there till maybe, what, 2017, 2018. So, like, he's been in the background for a long time, and got a feel for the players, and has a huge amount of experience, like, you know, so he can handle those situations quite well. And from what we saw, basically, of the documentary,
it was interesting when one of the players, when the scrum half Piranara was getting a start, he said, "I'm going to send him a text message and whatever," and the coach asked him, "What are you saying?" And he gave it a big spiel. And he said, "Would you not just do your role or something like that?" And he just cut it down short, sharp, and sweet, basically. He was very simplistic coaching his messages that he was giving across. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Just keep it short and simple. Like, that's probably a key to it. And we probably overemphasize it. And we talk too much. And there's too much words and too much instruction. And it's, look, you're playing this game all your life. You know what to do. Just do it and move on.
Yeah. And, like, look, I suppose we usually ask this question early, but we bypassed it as well. But what made you choose this to discuss, this show?
So, first of all, I'm a big fan of the All or Nothing documentaries. There's a load of them there. There's a load of NFL ones, from the Dallas Cowboys, from the Cardinals. I think the Eagles is there as well. There's a couple more. There's some college ones from the NFL as well. And there's obviously some football ones on Man City. There's a new one, a newish enough one of Tottenham, basically, which I haven't seen yet, but I have seen all the rest of them. I think Man City was the first one I saw, and I was hooked on it. And I was hooked on it because of the production, how good it was, the insight into the dressing room, the insight into, I suppose, the manager, the support team, and everything. And I was just fascinated by it. And I was like, right, love this. Straight onto the All Blacks one. And again, to the All Blacks, of course, anytime you get to see into their dressing room or into their meetings, you're all over it. How much are we seeing is another thing. But for me, what I saw, I was massively impressed by. And I think there's a lot of learnings you can get from a lot of those, from those series, to be honest. And I'm not an NFL supporter at all. I watch a couple of highlights every so often. But I loved the NFL side of things. Again, you're seeing a complete different sport. You're seeing completely different ways of managing, of coaching, of doing different things, different technologies, insight into the players, what they do, how they do things, you know. So just fascinating about the whole thing. Yeah. So really, I'm a big, big fan of the All or Nothing productions.
Yeah. And we'll tell you a little secret. The very best All or Nothing one, you might not watch yet, is the Australian cricket one.
That's not an All or Nothing, Massey. That's a different production.
No, it's All or Nothing.
No, you'll have to retract that, Massey.
Retract that. So. It's the best Amazon sports documentary.
It is very good, yeah. But, like, one of the things you mentioned there was about the support team, and I actually thought it was really insightful into that, like, there was a number. Like, I actually really liked the part with the scrum coach, or the scrum doctor, they called him. And, like, yeah. You know, they all kind of had defined roles, but they all had an input into the production of the team, like, let's say. And I think it's something a lot of time we'd see in the GA that, I know we mentioned a bit back in the start of season two with Shane Keegan about the selectors who are just leaning on the fence. Like, we have to start utilising these people a little bit better, like, don't we?
Yeah, like, I think rugby is different in that side of things to GA. First of all, like, you have different roles and different groups of players, like the forwards to the backs are massively different. And some of them won't do things that others do. So, you know, whereas the GA, you pretty much have everyone nearly. I know you've your defenders, midfield, and forwards, but that's all being kind of blended now to a certain degree these days in terms of runners, and you know, your half back line now is like an attack and forward line, and things are evolving, I suppose. But there definitely is kind of set coaches in rugby and NFL as well. Obviously, again, that's quite grouped and diverse too. But the GA is getting better. Like, and even in my own management team, like, I think everyone wants to do something. Like my management team are very much do not want to be standing cold on the sideline. So I think that day it could be nearly gone, to be honest. Like, people want to get their hands on the coaching. Like, you know, and I know from talking to other managers that some of the S&C coaches wants to do some of the skills coaching as well. Like, so everyone wants to put a hand on it. And I think everyone is getting more trained and more educated. And I suppose you're getting more empowered and you're taking on responsibility. And if you enjoy coaching, you're mad to do it. Like, so I think that's quite positive on that side of things. And that gentleman you mentioned, the scrum doctor, you know, he's some really nice cues, some really nice analogies. You know, I think one of them was, just from memory, was like, you're in the elevator on level three now or something. You're in the elevator level three, you know, and he's able to go up and go down basically with that in terms of the pressure they're putting on in the scrum. So really, really good analogies like that they're hard to come by, and it's a good thing to have as a coach in your bank basically.
Another thing he had in that was he talked about injury prevention, right? And obviously there's so much force and power going through a player's body in that scrum situation. But I think at times in hurling in particular, and particularly at the younger age group, when we're kind of going through that skill acquisition period where we're trying to teach hooking and blocking, and there is that element of danger involved in it, that those people who aren't, that those coaches who are there who haven't got a huge amount of playing experience, they kind of veer away from it and go, well, you know, I'm actually not going to get involved in this side of things at all for fear of doing it wrong. But it's certainly an area where, for me, around hooking and blocking and defensive skills, where there is an opportunity to get hurt, we do, there's a gap there in on the hurling side of things, definitely.
That's on the underage side of things, Paulie, is it?
Yeah, on the underage side of things, I think it's something that really, really needs to be worked on. And like, there's an element of it in terms of even the sound of a block can be quite intimidating for a young lad or a young girl hurling, particularly if you're in the indoor setting, and trying to build through the phases of trying to eliminate that fear in kids is important, and have that safety, that psychological safety there in terms of when you're coaching them skills to them, so they're not going to get hurt and veer away from it.
Yeah, create memories, bad memories for themselves. Eh?
that's a good point. Like, funny enough, it's, if you have a coach, basically, again, at underage, we have a lot of volunteers, and you have volunteers from like people who never really played hurling or camogie, for example. And it can be quite difficult for them. And if someone is quite new to hurling, and they see hurdles swinging straight away, there's fear straight away. What in God's name is going on here? They have to be careful. Whereas we've been brought up since we're 4 or 5 years of age with a hurl. And like, I still remember the time, I think maybe it was at a summer camp, and I think 7 or 8, where the coach was like, you will not get a belt for the hurl if you're in nice and close to the opposition player. So get in there as close as possible and you're safe. And that's stuck with me. Like, I can still picture that at this time. And that's the safest place to be. If you're a yard or two out from him, that's when you'll get caught with the end of the hurl. And I think it's those really good coaches, you know, that's important. And, you know, that's where the fear dissipates. And I never had any fear when I was younger, because it was just a natural thing to do, a natural environment to be in. And the break for hurl or the clash of hurls would be just normal. Like, so I think it depends on the environment, and I think it depends on the coach. And I suppose those people who are coming in, it's very important that, I suppose, they are getting the right side of the coaching, and that they do instill that kind of confidence and bravery into kids, you know, because I suppose that's how I was brought up, and maybe it's a bit more raw, but you know, I still kind of very much impressed by the coaching that I got back then. Like, there were certain cues and certain analogies that were said to me that just made a lot of sense, and they stuck with me all this time.
And like, obviously, Ballyhale, and it is very much viewed as a nursery of hurlers.
Yeah, and a nursery is the right word. And to be honest, like, it's probably, it's hard to even put a name on it. It's just the way it is. It's just the way of life. And like, we didn't have any football. Sorry, we had a small bit of Gaelic football, all right, but we had no real soccer or anything like that in the school. Like, soccer actually wasn't allowed in the school, first of all, and that's where you play most of your sport, is in a school. And we played hurling basically every day nearly. So it was just a way of life, and you're brought up. My family obviously are steeped in hurling as well. So it does depend on the environment. It depends on where you're from, the resources, what's around you. Like, you know, we had a nice big field out the back of our school. And that was key, like, you know, because I know other schools that didn't have that, and it didn't have that resource, and we had it, and we utilized it to the max. And I hear in certain schools, when the weather's not great, they're not maybe allowed out for weeks out to the back of the field. And I'm like, God above, this is madness. Like, let them out. They can put on tracksuits over their pants. That's what we used to do. And you keep that tracksuit pants there in the corner, and you put it on every day. Like, so I think we have to get back to that kind of, that roughness nearly, because that's key to health, to life, to the social side of things, and obviously to the game itself.
I can actually remember a time there. I was in sixth class and in primary school, and we had a fella, Brother O'Connell, and you know what, it had been a really big impact on me. Tipperary man, but we won't hold that against him. But I remember we were outside, and every lunchtime it was out into the field, play Gaelic games, and football in the first half of the year and hurling in the second half of the year, and that's just what you done. But I remember one day he'd get involved in the game, and on different days he'd pick on a different fella, right? And he'd kind of get stuck into you. And like, I can remember one day he broke a hurl over me legs. But I was only thinking about it recently enough. I'm convinced the hurl was broken before he hit me, right? And that he was doing it to try and build up that element that, gee, like, because I can remember, I went away thinking I was a king.
Hard as nails.
Yeah, because like, he was all talk, because he was my teacher at the time. He was all talk for the rest of the day, the rest of the hour of the day. Geez, I broke a hurl off him there, and he's away down there, not a bother on him for the rest of the day, you know? And he would have systematically done that with different fellas from time to time. And you'd be on top of the world after, like, thinking you're stronger than you actually are. Like,
isn't it amazing the kind of people that were back then teaching us and coaching us, and even him planning that, which he did, as you said, like, you know, and the purpose of it was to make you more brave, to make you confident, and to give you that strength basically and confidence. So it's a lot of good people back then, you know, as I said, really good coaches. And it must have came natural to them. Like, you know, I know they probably read books and what have you, but they don't have the resources that we have today in terms of the internet and that, and how quickly we can get resources and information.
One of the things from the film that I was impressed with the All Blacks was the way they were able to integrate in these young new players based into the lineup, and these boys were all of a sudden nearly the best players. Like, just the integration, like, and look, I know the All Blacks, they talk about values and stuff like that, but like, it's something as well that you'd have in your own club. Like, the win fellas do come up to the level, they're at the level. It's not a case of sinking for a few matches and getting by. Like, they just seem to kind of be at it and ready to go. And is it down to like just values and community and culture, or is there more simple way of it? Like,
yeah, look, I think for the club side of things, I think it's the environment more than anything. And I think, look, we don't exactly announce our values. I think it's just our behaviours, and, you know, people copy behaviours, and it's all that environment, as I said, that culture that's kind of, that's implicitly there, you know, like you don't exactly talk about it. There's not signs or any of that kind of stuff. Like, so I think behavior is the key to a lot of it. And and like, look, as the players come up, like it does take a bit of time. It could take a year or two maybe. And look, someone transition quite quickly. A year or two is savage, to be honest, to get in onto a senior team quite quickly and to make that impact. But we've been fortunate, very, very fortunate down in our small club. And look, there's no major secret. secret. Like, it does go back to your family, it goes back to the school, it goes back to the club, and that's key. And it's just everyone kind of helping out each other. And, you know, as I said, we none of us play rugby, or we're not distracted with other sports, and that does help. Like, even though we all play other sport, like, we still play them all, but like, hurling was number one. There was never an issue of, like, go play this soccer match now or play hurling. Like, it was never, that would never come up. So definitely, played multiple sports, but hurling was number one the whole time. And that's a big advantage, I think. And I think that's where the difficulty lies in other clubs, where they're being pulled from other sports. And, you know, it depends on your family, I suppose, as well. Was your father or your mother involved in those sports when they were younger? And have they got a passion for what direction you want to go? So, you know, you can be influenced in that side of things as well. But the values, just to touch on that, I suppose we're probably seeing more about values now in senior teams, obviously, and obviously at international. And obviously the All Blacks are probably one of the biggest teams for it. Stuart Lancaster talks a lot about values as well, and behaviour and attitude, and you know, that's a very fascinating area, to be honest. And look, you can have all that, and I think it's massively important, and I think they are the pillars, they are the foundations that you need in any team. But it doesn't automatically mean you're going to win. You might never win, but I suppose at least if you have them, you're going in a certain direction and you're building on something. But the key is to keep that momentum going. A lot of those teams that I mentioned, or a lot of those sports that I mentioned, they're results-based business, you know. And if you're not winning, you might be let go within the space of a year, 2-3 years. So you don't have that long, you don't have that amount of time basically to try and make an impact.
Like, from an underage perspective, then, like, I'd imagine, like, if I'd be looking to fail at team, fail at results and stuff like that. Like, and it'd be more the city teams would be the thing. Like, is there a huge emphasis on trying to win all these underage tournaments, or is it just like the goal, I'd imagine, should be, let's get players into the, stay in the club as long as they can in whatever role that they end up in?
Yeah, have you went to an under-12 match, Colm, lately, by any chance, or an under-10 match there in any club there? Did you ever see the sidelines?
I do, I see the parents on the sideline, all right, yeah. I'll be trying to shoot them.
that will tell you the story there. Like, you know, like, it's, look, we have competitive natures, you know. I suppose the narrative these days is to say, like, look, we're developing them further down the field. That's the narrative that's being put out there. Does that happen? I suppose some clubs might try and do it, but it's hard. As I said, it is a results-based business. People like winning, kids like winning, they don't like losing, parents like winning, they like seeing their child, you know, bring home some silverware. So there is a huge, you know, I suppose, conflict there to a certain degree. But I think for me, if I was a coach at that age, like, I probably would bring in the parents at the very start of the year and lay out what my plan is for your child. And it's your health, it's the development of them, making them happy, trying to get as much game time into them as possible, share the game time between all the players. Like, you know, like, I think if you lay that out at the start and say to any parent, have you got any issue with this? And if none of them say anything, well, then I think you have a base there and you can always go back to that. I flagged this at the very start. This is the way I was doing it, and I'm sticking to this philosophy. I'm sticking to this structure. I'm not changing because Mary's ringing me now saying, why is my son not playing yesterday? And you can get caught up in those kind of issues. Like, so it's very difficult, to be honest. But yeah, the narrative is, I suppose, you're developing them for further down the line. And rugby in particular have these academies in place, and they are building, that they're grabbing students, you know, from different places. They're going to obviously certain schools to try and get into these academies. Like, we've the provinces, you know, you have an academy, you have a sub academy, there could be one below that as well. So that's very much the development and getting them ready for later stages in terms of, I suppose, under 20 and senior.
Yeah, like, and parents are kind of, they're the unspoken shareholder a lot of the time, aren't they? Like, we just completely, like, the player, the child is obviously the number one stakeholder. The parent is the most influential person on them. And a lot of the time we just completely ignore their existence, like.
Yeah, and they have a huge influence. And look, they're massively part of this, and the amount of time and effort that they put in, like, they're like taxi people these days, like, with the sport, with all the sports that are being played. And I suppose, look, it's probably a good thing that you're being a taxi person, because obviously they're out and about and they're mixing with friends and they're playing with teams and they're healthy and their fitness and all that. That's all massively important. Like, but yeah, no, they are really, really important. And that's why I suppose you got to bring them in, I think, and if you want to have a successful kind of year, and I'm not about silverware, but just kind of a successful year where you've no major major issues, bring him in at the start, make them part of it, you know, try and get him in for training sessions as well to help out with the coaching. And at the end of the day, if your philosophy is to develop all of them, to try and get as many kids in as possible on this team, well, then that's the goal, or that's the vision for the year. And I think, you know, you'd be somewhat satisfied with that as a parent, I think, like, if that is the key goal and you know it from the outset. And that goes back to communication. So communication is key.
There was one part of the show that I found very interesting, that Bowden Barrett, and I was just thinking about it in context of Ballyhale. Bowden Barrett was the kicker, and he wasn't the best kicker in the world. And McKenzie came in, who was a sort of a young gun, probably superior kicker, but he had to take his time before that responsibility was passed over from him. So I was thinking of Shefflin, one of the greatest free takers players of all time, and then young TJ Reid, who is like one of equally as good a free taker as him. So how did that go? Like, was it just that Henry's a senior player, I take the freeze until I retire, and then you come along, TJ, and follow me? Or yeah, is there any debate about that in the dressing room? Or
it's probably unspoken to a certain degree, I suppose. You know, Henry would have taken him for, you know, a large period of time, and probably did so up until maybe the last 2 or 3 years. And maybe at that time he was more focused on his game and performing on the field, and maybe taking the pressures off the free side of things, the free taking, you know, that could ease that side of things. So I think it happened naturally more than anything. I think, to be fair to TJ, he was waiting in the wings, basically, because, you know, he's a super free taker as well, and basically was just waiting his time until Henry was ready to pass it on, you know, respectively, to be fair. I would have noticed, or I would have observed with Kilkenny, you know, the time Henry would have went through his cruciate injuries, and he went through, I think, three of them, and Richie Power maybe would have been taking freeze at that time, and there could have been someone else. And I remember, you know, this is going to get a bit awkward now. You know, what's going to happen when he comes back? You know, and to be fair, he stood back up, like, you know, and just took it on. And I have one memory of that now. I don't know how true is it now, to be honest, because it's phasey enough. But I think, you know, I remember Richie was saying, yeah, look, I'll take the longer ones out past the 65 maybe or something. I think he was saying that. And I recall one that was out past the 65 and Richie wasn't taking it. Let's put it that way. And Richie would have been very good at freeze as well. Like, you know, he would have taken him in different games and would have taken freeze when he was under 20 and 21 at the time as well. So yeah, look, I suppose if you hand it over once, you know, you mightn't get it back, you know, and taking freeze is not an easy job. There's a lot of pressure on it. Like, and to be fair, Henry was, you know, he's massively ambitious, I suppose, you know, and I think DJ Carey actually would have passed it on to Henry when Henry was very young, actually, maybe 19 years of age, even, like, so.
Did they share? Did DJ take the long ones for a while? Do I remember correctly? Did DJ take the ones from the 65 out and Henry took the close in ones?
There could have been a mix of that. Yeah, Henry would have been playing corner forward at that time. And DJ was excellent at, like, you know, 70, even 80 yards. He could be popping them over. Like, so there was an element of that, maybe, definitely. And look, I'd say Henry is probably delighted to be getting on freeze in some shape or form at that age. Mm. And then eventually just, you know, naturally took over, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a part in the film as well that's kind of echoes what's been said there, where Ben Smith was told, you know, take a break there for a period of time, you know. And he'd had a couple of head injuries and just needed to get himself right. But he was going, yeah, you know, I'm happy with the break, but it is giving other people a chance, you know. And one of the things you could see in it, like, is that they did give people chances when they maybe weren't as good as the people who they were replacing. But there was that kind of that marginal difference there where, you know what, we need to get this fella some game time, because if we don't, and we need him for that 10 or 15 minute period, he's not going to be actually up to it at that stage. So we need to expose them. And Stuart Lancaster talked about in Leinster that kind of curve of when we'll say the upcoming player is meeting the player on the downward path, and it isn't necessarily at the point where they meet that they exchange. It might be a little bit before that, and that's a critical thing. Like,
yeah, it is, without a doubt. And look, it's probably a difficult time for the player who is on the way down. And I think a lot of time you are always trying to get a player in there to get game time and to see how to get on, and not wait until actually that existing player is completely gone. Like, you want someone to be in there, get an experience, because when they do take over, they're ready and they're not completely raw going in. And I think, like, even like from the show, from the documentary, like anytime the players were dropped or they didn't make it, like, you know, you could see how devastated they were. And even like passing it on to the next player, like, was still massively difficult. Like, you know, you nearly, you know, be shedding a tear, to be honest, you know. And I think that's what I loved about the show as well, the kind of the passion that the players had and that brotherhood, and they knew it was the right thing for the team, and they knew they had to just take that decision, that manager, obviously the management decision, and just wish that player the best of luck, and then if you get a chance, basically you go again yourself, like. So that competition for places, look, that's key for a successful environment. You need to have that. You need players striving to make the first 15 or first 11, whatever it is, basically. And if you have that, well, then you have a healthy environment, you have a healthy panel, and then, you know, hopefully you get bigger performances.
I think it's the quote in the documentary where subs need to change the negative and add to the positive games. I thought it was very simply defined what you want from your subs that are going on in a game. Is something that's going wrong, you have to go in to change it and create something positive as a result. And I thought the whole way through this film that was in their culture. As soon as you're brought on, you have to make an impact.
Did you see what they call them, Mossy? They didn't call them subs. Did you see the name?
Run-ons,
yeah. So I think, like, substitutes, I think they looked at that as maybe an insult, maybe, or a negative, or something like that, like to the player. And you know, personally, I don't see that myself. But the run-ons, yeah, like they did create, I suppose, a mindset there, or an angle where, like, look, this is actually, if you're a run-on, like, this is massively important, and you will be coming on, like, so you've got to make that impact, and you're really important to the team, and you're really important to the performance and the potential success of that game, like. So you know being a run-on, you're like, Jesus, it's not too bad, you know, I'm happy enough, like, you know, to a degree, like, you know. So I think, look, that is important as well, and we are seeing that in the GA too. Like, you normally do see five subs coming on in majority of games, and, you know, from Dublin, the Gaelic footballers, you know, we've seen five that come on, and that normally, you know, they drive the game home, or else they come on and they change the game, and how influential they are when they come on. So it's just that healthy competitive panel to have, and some teams, you know, are in good places on that.
Yeah, it's a huge help. One of the things that I actually really liked, and I suppose, look, a small bit I'd probably compare it again, going back to the GA, the technical coaching that they actually did. No, rugby is a technical sport. Hurling is as technical a sport as anything out there. But have coaches a small bit, like, gone away from the little, do you know, the little things that you'd see a player doing wrong? And are we correcting those players, or offering help to those players? As much as, like you spoke about in the past, you know, we had great coaches. We probably had one coach in the club who coached probably 100 kids in a year, like, at different age groups. But, like, is that one of the things that we're losing a small bit, is the defined technical coaching, that we're not actually helping them to improve? We're putting together the training, the activities, the games and drills or whatever we're doing. Or are we able to fine-tune those little things?
Yeah, Colin, that's a really good viewpoint. And look, I'll be honest about it, I'd be very much the person of trying to develop the player. So even though they're inter-county players coming into you, I think there's huge room and huge capacity to improve. And I've been like that as a player myself. The environment you create and the learning environment you create is really important, and to challenge a player and make them better. Like, that's the way the players come into it for a large part. And it is your job to try and make them better and to try and reach their potential. And that one-to-one stuff, it can be difficult, but that's where maybe you might have smaller groups, you know, the defenders with the defense coach, forwards with the offense coach in some cases, or you might be trying to break down a skill. So, no, I'd be very much of that mindset. Even catching, like, you know, the technique to catch, I think it's massively important. I was only average at it, but I just always found that if you just practice the technique and got that right, it would automatically happen on game day. There is some boys that are just naturally brilliant at it, and they don't have to think about it at all. But for the majority, you know, there's definitely room for improvement there on it. And I think it is hard to get it into a session, because although we do it, but I'd like to do more. But you only have them for an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes, and, you know, it means pulling out a player and doing a bit of one-to-one with him, and there's nothing wrong with that, but just that could mean then if you're playing a game, there's one player down, and whereas rugby, you know, professional sport, you could have these boys for 3 hours on the field, and, you know, you could say tomorrow, you, you're coming at me, we're going to practice a scrum, we're going to practice throwing, catching, whatever it is, you know, so they have the time to break it down. They can look at a bit of video analysis to drive home their points, their coaching points, their learning points. But just in the GA, we've so little time. It's very hard to have that time to do the players.
And is it?
Yeah, the ball alley, which is super, you know. But again, like it's the work they do outside of the training ground. Nearly, I think Mossy and you're on the ball and that. Like it's for me again, you want to be coming to train and having all those kind of weaknesses maybe cleaned up or those areas that you need to work on. You know, you're after doing a bit of work on it and you're coming in then at a really good level for the training session. That's the ideal scenario. But like, look, these lads train 3 nights a week, probably gym another night of the week. You know, and in their ball alley or whatever it is, you know, 5 nights of the week. You know. 5-6 nights of the week, it's full on. And look, there's nothing wrong with it, but just lives are busy. People have jobs, kids, college, you know, you name it. Girlfriends, boyfriends. So it's just trying to fit it all in, like, you know. It's key.
Does it come back to a bit of reflection from the player then, to acknowledge that, what can I do better? Like, is that something that happens where players ask you, how can I improve this part or how can I improve that part? Without, like, look, I know some players would say it's trying to just suck up a small bit and show a bit of vulnerability. But, like, is there that kind of option for the player, let's say, to go, Jesus, look, make any tips, look, and what can I do to improve the catching the ball, you know, and just finding them struggling a small bit? Like, is it a bit of self-reflection needed?
Yeah, like, I think, like, all I can talk about it really is the Offaly players, and they're very much, there's an appetite for that learning, and I suppose they could be conflicted maybe in some ways. I think they know me better now at this stage, and obviously build up a stronger relationship. I suppose at the start they might be a bit conflicted. If I tell this fella I'm poor at catching, he'd be like, this fella's brute, and I'd be looking at him dropping balls all day long, or if my touch is not good, I'm constantly looking at that touch, you know. So, like, I can pick up in the space of a couple of seconds whose touch is good, who's catching, you know, their vision for delivering ball, like, you name it. Like, you pick up them things very, very quickly. And you might ask a player, so tell me about the strong points of your game, tell me about the weaker points of your game, are the areas that you need to work on? And it comes up quite quickly, you know, and they're quite honest. And you're like, look, work on that, get at that. And if you need something from me or the management team or I'm on the backroom team, come on, and we try and get to train a bit earlier sometimes and work actually on the wall ball, and we have some rebounders there as well that we'd work on. And it's just trying to get into that, get into that habit and that environment and that behavior. And I suppose the more automatic I see that, the better for me. Like, you don't want to be pulling teeth, you want lads to be actually doing it, and actually saying to me, come on, be at training at a certain time, I'll be there, let's work on this, like, you know. So look, there's a bit of bravery there from the player, I think. But as I say to him, we're here to help you, we're here to make you better. Like, call upon us, it's our job at the end of the day.
Yeah, very good. I suppose, look, there wasn't a huge pile extra. Like, one of the things, as I said, other than the technical aspect, one of the things that I really liked was when Jerome Kano went down and coached 6-year-olds. How would you fancy your own chances of going down with the Ballyhale under-6s?
Yeah, well, I don't think I'd be down there on my own with this. I had a bit of experience there a number of years ago. I'd say probably could be 10 plus years ago at this stage, and doing a summer camp, and we decided to, I was looking after the 12-year-olds and absolutely flying, loving the sessions, doing county, senior inter-county drills with them, and they loving it, and like, really impressed by him, like, you know. So loved that aspect of it. And and next thing, after lunch, I think it was actually one of Richie Hogan's camps, and he said, right, we're going to circulate or recycle the coaches into different groups. And I ended up with the 5 and 6-year-olds, and I was like, okay, yeah, this is okay, 5, 6-year-olds, only for an hour or 2 grand. And I had a young person with me as well to give me a hand. And mother of God, like, it was just chaos. Like, between trying to get them to do anything was impossible. There's 2 or 3 wanted to go to the toilet. The toilet was about a mile away where the dressing room was. So I had to send my assistant or my apprentice off with those 3. And then 1 or 2 more would come up and say, they have to go to the toilet. And then you have to tie lacers as well at the same time. And it could be someone in a ditch, like we're close to a ditch, so one or two of them are in the ditch with their hurdles baiting briars. And I was like, this is manic. And I was completely lost, to be honest. And then I got to try and do some ground hurling together. That was just messy, and only a handful of them were doing it. And next thing I saw then, parents walking up the field, because I was at the very back. And I was like, mother of God, don't tell me they're coming up here to look at their children with me coaching them. And next thing, and it's like, they're coming up to me. But thankfully, the young fella was back from the toilet. And I was like, quickly set up the goals and get him into a game. And just looked like we're doing something right. And thankfully we did, like, and about 10 minutes, I was like, oh yeah, time to go home now. There's your parents. And the parents knew, were none the wiser about what just went on. But no, for me, it wouldn't be for me. I'd rather have someone there basically to try and orchestrate it and coordinate it. And no, actually, no, I wouldn't be any good. I wouldn't have the patience for it.
There's no bigger pressure for a coach than when you're coaching under six or sevens, when the parents come along the sideline watching.
Yeah, like under eights onwards, probably fine. But like you have to be a certain type. And I think it was their loose head. Was it Kane? Yeah, was he was doing a bit with him. And like, God, it's challenging. Like, you know, because like you're a professional player, you play at the highest level, or an inter-county player. And these things, they come automatic to you because you learned them from such a young age, and you're doing it all your life. And next thing someone asks you how to raise a ball, and you're like, you know, tell me how you do it. And you try to break it down, and you're talking too much, and you're not doing it right, and you're not saying it right, and you're probably confusing them. So it's amazing. Actually, there's a skill in it. There's a skill in coaching, and it's something that you need to practice and learn and educate. So yeah, no, look, I won't be doing it under five or sixes for a long period, maybe until my little fella comes up to that age, and I might go down and swing a hurl then, maybe, but not until then.
I thought that was actually, like, Jerome Kane was just so honest there. Like, he described exactly what you said, Nick, there. Like, he says, I took one session, never again. They don't listen. Like trying to herd stray cats. And, you know, it's a really important thing to do, because people just assume, be it Mick Fenley or Richie Hogan or whoever, can go down and coach them 5 or 6 year olds. But it's a completely different skill set required to deal with them. And that's why primary school teachers spend 4 years in college trying to learn how to deal with kids at that age, and get an understanding of the management around it. Like, it's tough going.
It's tough. Like, and look, a lot of cases you're just trying to manage the kids. And again, my previous memory to a teacher, actually, again, it was a summer camp years and years ago. And basically he was looking after 5 or 6 year olds, and he was passing the area that I was looking after. And here the kids were in a train. He was at the top of it, and they were, it was like a kind of probably a snake is a better example, just like a snake. And they were just following him, and they all had one hand on each other's back so no one get lost. And had it under complete control, and it looked easy. It looked so easy. But obviously, my own experience changed massively. So I know there's a huge skill set in it. And even when some coaches ask you to come down and have a word to the kids, you know, and you're like, well, what do I want to say to them? Like, you know, like there a lot. You get kind of stumped on it in terms of, like, especially if you're not used to that area. Like, I'm lecturing and I have a fair field, obviously, what kids and students need and how to speak to them and how to get their attention and all that. Like, again, that is a skill set in itself. But just a normal player, get a footballer, hurler, or a rugby player, it can be quite difficult for him, and can be quite scary at times, to be honest. And look, just going back to suppose the All Blacks lads and that all or nothing. Like, what I loved, I suppose, and I probably didn't get this point across earlier, was the All Blacks. I suppose, what do we know about them? They're invincible. You know, there's a superiority. They're not human, nearly. Like, that's the way they come across to me. Never play a bad game. They're just fierce, awesome team. And I suppose this show, you know, the camera, you know, we got a feel to the players, we got a feel to their anxieties, we got a feel to their, you know, their injuries, their bad days. Like, you know, number 10, what's his name, Barrett, had a bad game back in his hometown against Argentina, I think, and just, you know, completely skewed his kicks. So, like, they're normal people. And for me, that would nearly give you confidence if you were a rugby player to say, look, these are normal Joes. They're similar to myself. They have their good days and bad days. They're not invincible. they're not, they are human, and they go through the exact same emotions that we do, and they have good days and bad days, and I love that. And I suppose from a manager's perspective, seeing Stephen Henson, seeing him talk and how he, suppose he delivers his message and how he keeps the attention of the players and what he says, you know, I love that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, excellent. I think we nearly wrap it up. Dad, anything else you want to add in the film on the show, lads, before we go?
No, I really thought Kieran Reid is a class captain. He just comes across as a real cool customer, a cool guy. He's like he's just brilliant. And I thought the composure they showed in situations where a team might panic when they're losing a game, where they just knew they had the class, just stay composed, we'll get our chances. And it's just very similar to what you see, like, say, Dublin footballers or Kilkenny in the past. Like, you know, they don't lose the head. You just stay calm, and more than likely it'll work out well in the end because they're just so drilled on top.
And I think Paulie mentioned it earlier, like the simple phrase of do your job, like, you know, and I don't think that these boys are thinking, we have these lads, we'll go strong at the end. I just think they're still in the game, they don't panic, and they'll go to the 80th minute, and they don't think anything different. Like, the doubts don't creep into their minds. And I suppose if they're playing bad, what happens? They're going to be whipped off. There's going to be someone else in your shoes quite quickly. So I don't think anyone's going to be lacking near the end of a game. And Reid, he's all action for me. Like, you know, he's just a stalwart that just does the business and nothing fancy about it. Just does the hard yards. And I said, he's an action man. He delivers, you know, and you can't beat a captain like that. You know, he comes across as to me now, from the film or from the documentary, it could be completely wrong, but comes across maybe as a quietish enough person, you know, not really a party animal or anything, but just goes about his job in a really professional and really good manner, to be honest.
But I also loved the way that when he got the yellow card that time, he just went, yeah, okay, and he just took it and went off the field, you know. There was no, you know, if you can imagine the GA, you'd be like, oh, the referee did that to me. But it was excellent. But no, look, it's, yeah, that's probably it. Anything to plug there, Mike, or anything to, where can people find you if they want to, on Twitter or anything?
Nah, they don't need
rantings, rantings or ravings from you that they might, they want to find.
No, nothing at all, to be honest. No, look, keeping the head down here in Kilkenny. As I said, I'm working away in the PhD there, so head is buried in research, and I have a new baby on the way as well in April. So, and hopefully we'll hold them back in April, fingers crossed. So it's going to be busy few months ahead. But again, it's good, good challenging time coming up this now, next few months, and looking forward to it.
Excellent. Yeah, well, congratulations on that, and best of luck with the baby minding and fitting in the time to up to Offaly, and best of luck with Offaly for the year. So thanks very much for your time, Mike.
Cheers, man.
Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favourite platform, and if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Roy Orbison Tattoo, and we appreciate any likes, retweets, comments, or suggestions for future viewings. See you next week, everybody.